Hi, welcoming back to the program one of our favorites, actor, author, and storyteller, Stephen Tobolowsky. Hello there, Stephen.
Hey, Rich. Good to be in Maine again.
Nice to connect with you again. I'm once again admiring here through the miracle of Skype your bookshelf, your backdrop. You showed us a piece of the Berlin Wall last time. You've got some wonderful things back there.
Yeah, I can show you some. Well, this is radio.
It is. Important?
But I could describe this.
Oh, that's even better. We always like that kind of thing.
Can you see what I'm holding up, Rich? Can you describe that to your radio audience?
I would describe that as a stick.
Yes, sir. This is a stick, but it is no ordinary stick. This is a stick I picked up off the ground in Iceland.
Oh, not on that fateful Iceland trip.
The fateful Iceland trip in which I was thrown off of a horse on the side of an active volcano and broke my neck in 5 places. Doctor said I had a fatal injury. This stick was in a horse meadow, which the next morning after I was there in my neck brace, sitting with my dear wife Anne in the horse meadow, and the stick was beside me, and I picked up this stick, and for some reason, I decided I would keep it. I have no idea why, but over the years now, because that was broken neck, I don't know, Rich, as you live through your life, I've hit the big 7-0. As you go through your life, you kind of now categorize your catastrophes by date. I can't remember some of the good stuff, but my broken neck was 2008. So I've had this stick since 2008, and it has become a symbol that you can keep anything as long as you respect it, you protect it, you don't break it, and you honor what it is, and you'll have that memory forever. So this is my stick from Iceland.
Oh, it's a talisman now.
It's a talisman now. Now it is, you know, I could put it on a baseball cap and walk around with it. That's right.
That is wonderful. Speaking of your wife, Anne, I did want to mention, we'll talk about what you're doing, but looks like she is having a wonderful time doing the terrific David Lindsay Abaire play right in the middle of in Los Angeles, I believe, these days. Can you tell us about what she's been up
people.
To? Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It's such a great
spectacular.
Show.
Spectacular. It is a spectacular play, Good People. It is a spectacular play, and it's a wonderful production. And the thing Anne has done, she's a splendid director to begin with, and her specialty as a director is bringing performances out of people. And this play is spectacular. We've had people compare it favorably to the Broadway production, of just saying this is one of the greatest productions, certainly of this play, they've seen. But the thing that Anne does, that people don't understand what she does that's so great, is that she has some kind of hillbilly blood in her. Like she's from like the sticks in Georgia. And there is no quit in her. So as they began rehearsals for Good People, the roof of the theater collapsed onto the stage. The theater was bathed with toxic liquid. They had to close the theater. They had to clear everybody out. They had to get the city in there. They'd make sure that the water wasn't contaminated, didn't have COVID in there. It was a huge COVID, all this. So Anne, not quitting, not stopping, tells everybody, we're going to practice in my backyard, obeying social distancing. Everybody's going to have their COVID test. We're going to stay 6 feet apart, and we're going to work on this play until we see if we have a theater or not. And so by the time, I think it took about 4 weeks to build the theater, that meant she had 1 week in the theater before it opened.
Wow.
And there was no set, no nothing, but she went in there and she said, we're going to practice at my house, and then we're going to have a second practice in the theater. They opened it up, and it was spectacular. I got to say, it is wonderful. And the reviews it's been getting are just beautiful. And it's a real tribute not only to Anne, but to the wonderful cast, fantastic cast.
You mentioned directing. From your experience, whether it's stage, film, or television, what kind of director are you looking for as an actor?
Boy, And you put your finger on the pulse, because it really depends if you're talking about stage, television, or theater. If you're talking about theater, you've got a rehearsal period. Like on Broadway, you can have 10 weeks. I think for Mornings at 7, we maybe had 8 weeks of rehearsal and then 2 or 3 weeks of preview. You had a lot of time. So Dan Sullivan, who was our director for that show, spectacular director, he kind of lets you grow into the part because you have that kind of time. When you're doing a film, you have not that kind of time, but you do have time to rehearse a little bit, and the director kind of works mainly with the cinematographer to see how we're going to shoot this. But the really wonderful directors I've worked with, like Ridley Scott and Barbe Schroeder, Alan Barker, oh my God, what a genius. The thing the really great film directors do is when you do theater, the hit of theater is recreating reality, right? So the audience is sitting in their chairs. They know they're not seeing something real. They know these people have costumes and have rehearsed these lines, but somehow, if it's right, the reality of what happens on stage sucks you into the experience on stage and you love it. However, film, you don't have that. Because as an audience member, every time there's a camera edit, every time music comes into a scene or there's a special effect, you realize that there's a puppet master behind the scene. So the hit of reality is not what moves you when you see movies. The thing that moves you in cinema is surprise. And the really great directors like Alan Parker, Ridley Scott, Barbe Schroeder, who I did Single White Female with, what they do is they create a situation that as an actor, you're going to be surprised. And they capture that on film, and that translates to an audience in sitting in the theater watching it. Now, television. Television. You have 5 days, man. You have 5 days between when you see the script and you film it in front of a live audience, like one day at a time. Or like the Goldbergs, which is filmed, you have no rehearsal. You're doing 5 to 10 pages of script a day. Californication, you've got nothing. So you have to be able to improvise. They kind of tell you where to stand, and you have to be free as an actor. You need a director that just minds the boundaries and says, go for it, man. It gives you permission to go for it because they have to capture the rawness of that experience for a TV show to work.
Have you ever had a director who gave you line readings?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. On Californication, we had a director at one point, and very famous, but the director would say, Stephen, on this line, saying, what is that? A gun? And I go, well, you know, I'm Stu Beggs. I go, what is that, a gun? No, Stephen, what is that, a gun? I go, no. But it was so frustrating because I don't think I worked that way in high school. And you know, certainly when we did Groundhog Day, Harold Ramis, you know, he just let Bill Murray and I go. You know, it's like, okay, if it's working, don't fix it.
Right.
Yes. No, it is extremely frustrating. It shows that the director doesn't trust you. Mm. And trust is the center of any activity that has to do with acting. Either you have to, on theater, you have to trust your partner on stage. In film, you have to trust your director and cinematographer. And I think in something like the Goldbergs, as a cast and as a crew, we all trust one another.
I was reading, and we had Mark on the show, Mark Harris's wonderful book about Mike Nichols. And his unique take on directing, which was often just to sit down with actors and talk about personal experiences from his life, trying to get them open up. And that was often his method of getting people to understand the character they were portraying.
That's and you know, that is a modern shorthand for what Stanislavski would call trying to create the 24-hour life of the character by using sense memory. You go back and find little things in your life that correspond to the character, and if you could create the 24-hour life of a character, you can do anything from Romeo to Juliet. I remember Ed K. Martin was a great acting teacher I had. And he said, the only two things you need to know as an actor is what is my greatest hope and what is my greatest fear. If you know those two things, that creates a tightrope, and your character walks on that. Every other question spins off of those two things. Now, I had Ed K. Martin in graduate school, and Holly Hunter had Ed K. Martin, I think, in undergraduate school at Carnegie Mellon. And I remember Ed K. Martin called me up when I graduated at University of Illinois. Well, I didn't graduate. I ran away from it. I left my master's degree after 1 year saying, I'm gone.
Right.
Ed K. Martin called me at home and said, I'm doing a production of Bus Stop. Would you like to play Bo in Bus Stop? And I said, absolutely, Ed. He said, I have a great Sherry for you. She's an actress I've been working with at Carnegie Mellon. She's absolutely wonderful, a girl named Holly Hunter. And I go, oh, Ed, I'm sure she's going to be great. You know, whoever this Holly girl is, I'm sure she's going to be great. I ended up dropping out of Bus Stop because my girlfriend Beth at the time was saying, like, well, I don't want you going to Michigan in the winter to do this play over the holidays. So I called up Ed and he said, well, Holly Hunter dropped out too for the same reason. And it turned out a few years later, Holly Hunter and I played boyfriend and girlfriend on Broadway in Beth's play, The Wake of Jamie Foster. Wow. And so, you know, the pool in acting, you know, it's a small pool, but it's deep, you know.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. Let's talk about the Goldbergs in the news lately. Some issues there with Jeff Garlin. You've worked on the show for 8 years now. What's happening with the show and what's happening with your role?
Yeah, I just heard about that yesterday, about Jeff not doing the Goldbergs anymore. And, you know, I don't know the exact truth of it. I've done many scenes with Jeff, and he's always funny. He's always full of energy. And, you know, I don't know anything about making an unpleasant set to work on. But one thing that's happening with the Goldbergs that may be behind this entire thing, too, with Jeff, is that with COVID, we are undergoing a lot of new restrictions. Mm. In the old days, we would do an episode of the Goldbergs in 5 days. We would start on Monday and end on Friday. Now, on the show, I've done 5 shows so far this season on the Goldbergs. We're scheduled for 2 weeks because you never know when someone's going to test positive. And they have to juggle around which scenes they shoot. And sometimes they'll shoot scenes for one show several weeks later after the person has a few negative tests under them. It's very complicated now. And I think in terms of Jeff, scheduling could have been a conflict for him. Scheduling, just being able to be free all the time to be able to do that, because he has a lot of irons in the fire too. And a lot of things happening. And so it could be just difficult for him. And you know, the Goldbergs, I think, just like Law and Order, I've worked on a couple of the Law and Order shows. Goldbergs is in the same category. It is at the top of the list. Everything on those shows work like magic, because the crew, the actors, the cast, the directors, everybody works like clockwork, and they get the show done. You know, if you can't work like clockwork, it may be too difficult. So anyway, I wish I wish Jeff the best. I know that the shows this year on Goldberg's have been hilarious.
Well, and we were
so the writing is very strong. And yesterday, besides the news of Jeff, which was shocking, my manager called up and said, Goldberg's has just been extended for four more shows this season because of the success of it. So we're shooting four more shows. So the writing is the strength of that show. And as long as the writing is strong, as long as we've got Wendy and Sean, we have a powerful show.
Well, and we were talking before we came on the air. You've had some fun episodes this season. One of my favorites was when Wendy's character wanted to make sure that the non-athletes in the school were treated as well and honored as much as the athletes. And, well, you had a lot of two-handed scenes with Wendy and also with Sean. They were just great.
That show was so hard to get through because it was so funny. And one of the things that makes it funny is it's true. And at least my high school was that. Everything was for the athlete and nothing was for the non-athlete. And so for our less coordinated students, we're going to have a non-athletic senior day. I mean, but you know, it's true. The chess club, they never did that. The people who played the piano, those people were never recognized. Our school was only football. That's all, blocking and tackling. We've had some really delightful shows. And one of the things the Goldbergs does that's really kind of special, and I haven't seen it in that many shows, they're able to tell an exaggerated story and in doing so highlight the truth. And one of the things that's exaggerated is Adam Goldberg's story as a real person, as a boy growing up, filmed all these sequences from his life. And as we all look back, like me and the damn stick here in the day, you know, as we look back on our life, these things from our past, the talismans, become exaggerated. And the Goldbergs is able to tell an exaggerated story, and it still has the ring of truth. And that's a really magical formula. And that comes down to really wonderful writing and wonderful directing.
Well, and so many talented actors, yourself included in that, obviously. Losing George Siegel, but then a wonderful episode following up on that with the great Judd Hirsch.
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there is such a respect for actors on the set. Every time you're on the set, even with this COVID nightmare going on, you feel like you are respected, and also the actors respect the crew. The people, just to give, we were talking about Stanislavski and the 24-hour life of a character that an actor wants to create. On the crew of the Goldbergs, we have Buddy, who's one of our prop master. He comes up to me and he says, in this scene, Principal Ball, you have a briefcase. So I was thinking, what kind of a briefcase would you have? So I figured you would have a briefcase that was maybe given to you as a gift, maybe when you did graduate school, and you've had this suit briefcase for the last 40 years. And so I went back and I got this leather case that dates back to when you probably went to graduate school, and it has, and I'm going like, that is the thought process an actor goes through.
Right.
And here is, you know, and the prop people on the Goldbergs, they think that through on every little prop that you have as to what kind of a pen would you have in your office? What kind of a pad are you writing on? And it's magnificent. I have one episode, I don't know if they've shown it yet, in which we have to, for Beverly Goldberg, we have to redo the charter of the school and to remove her from being in the line of succession. If anything happens to the principal, the vice principal, then, you know, the Quaker warden gets to take charge. So we do a coup to take Beverly Goldberg out of the chain of succession. And I cannot believe it. The prop department came up with an entire document that that was the school the school charter that was 100 pages long. And within this charter, it had my speeches written into the text of the charter. So me, if I had trouble on my lines, all I had to do was read the lines right off of the charter.
That's fantastic.
I mean, they're thinking ahead.
That's attention to detail. Well, and it shows in the final product.
Yes, it's terrific.
You mentioned that you've been doing a lot of voiceover work lately. What kind of things you've been working on?
It's nuts. It's a skill that I always wanted, and I've always marveled at the people like Pam Adlon on Californication. Oh. And Pam is like one of the queens of voiceover. Julia Cato, who I worked with on One Day at a Time, she played one of the mothers on Rugrats and several roles on Rugrats, and she has like 500 credits. You know, these people, it is a very specific skill, which I've always wanted to learn. And I've done a few shows now. I did a Peabody and what is it? Peabody and Sherman?
Peabody and Sherman, yes.
Okay. Now, I don't know if we discussed it here, but I got that part not from my voiceover work, but from doing the Tobolowsky Files podcast.
Oh, well there.
And the podcast in particular, in which I was thrown from the horse in Iceland and broke my neck, because the writer-producer had just come from a horseback riding trip in Iceland. And so he heard that and said, I need that voice in Peabody and Sherman.
Wow.
So he called me up. They called me up and they said, you have this part. You don't have to audition. And we have drawn the part to be you. And I go, wow. So I show up and he shows me a picture of the part. It's the most horrifying looking self-portrait I ever saw. You got this little guy, the big Adam's apple, bald, you know, bulging eyes, glasses, big long nose, you know, like skinny arms. I'm thinking, oh my God, I need to work out more. And another one I got because of me was Archer.
Oh yes.
Right? Yeah. Show Archer. So I was in, and again, I don't know if I told this story on your show. I was in Finland, and we were doing One Day at a Time, and Mike Royce, the executive producer, said, can you come from Helsinki to Austin, Texas? We're having a meeting, a producer's meeting about One Day at a Time, and we're going to do a Q&A here. So I said, yes. There is a nonstop flight from Helsinki to Austin, Texas.
Who knew?
And let me tell you, man, you're watching a lot of movies on that flight. Let me tell you, that is a long flight. Got to Austin, Texas, got to the hotel, met Mike Royce in the lobby. He said, let's go eat Mexican food. Now, here's a true Hollywood story. We leave the hotel and are going down the crosswalk, crossing a street in Austin, Texas. Coming the other way is another man named Mike, and goes, wait a minute, Stephen Tobolowsky? And I go, yeah. He says, hi. I'm one of the executive producers and writers of the TV show Archer. And we were thinking about you for a part on Archer because you're a character actor and you're in all these different shows. And so we thought it would be hilarious if, as a character actor, you would be on Archer. And we're going to draw our character to look exactly like you. And I'm thinking of Peabody and Sherman. I'm going like, oh, God. And I go, well, sure, I would love to. He says, okay, we'll send you scripts and we'll start recording right away. And Stephen, if you could do me a favor, I know you're on that show One Day at a Time, and I really love it, and I have a pitch idea I wanted to do. Could you possibly introduce me to someone involved in the show? And I go, Mike, meet Mike.
There you go.
Here's our executive. True story in a crosswalk in Austin, Texas. And I must say, I just last week did two more episodes on Archer, and my character on Archer looks very much like me.
Oh, good, so good.
I'm very happy about that. And I'm a billionaire.
Even better.
Even better.
Fantastic. I don't want to take up too much time, but I want to ask you about one other show that you've done, because I love the show. It didn't have a long run, but what was your experience doing John from Cincinnati?
Gosh. That was pretty great. That was David Milch, and he used a lot of us guys that were in Deadwood.
Right.
And so the drill was we'd be shooting deadwood, and he was thinking that David Milch was thinking about season 4 of Deadwood, which never happened, right?
Right.
And he said, in the meantime, let's get this John from Cincinnati thing going. And he called me up at home and he said, Stephen, are you available today? And I go, yes, sir, for what? He says, I'm doing a new show, John in Cincinnati. How long would it take you to get to San Diego? I go, well, I'm living in Los Angeles. He says, so that'll be two and a half hours. Okay, start driving now, and we'll see if we could shoot your scene tonight. I'm going, David, I don't even know what we're doing. He says, don't worry about that. Just get to San Diego. So I say to Annie, I said, Annie, I think I got a job in San Diego. I don't know what this is. John from Cincinnati, I have no idea what this show is. So I drove down to San Diego, got there, and David greeted me and said, oh, we're running late on set, so we're not going to be able to shoot your scene tonight, but we'll shoot it tomorrow. And I go, David, I don't even know what we're shooting. I don't know what the show is. I don't know what my part is. He says, oh, well, let me give you a script. So he gives me a script, and I have all these lines. I'm like an attorney or something. But again, we got to work out with all of our friends from Deadwood. So I really had very little idea what I was doing. But I think, what was I saying before about directors? David Milch was one of those guys who liked to inject surprise into the mix. And so we were all fighting for our lives on any of his shows, trying to remember what the hell we were doing.
Well, I love the show. I was hoping for more of it, but
yeah,
the business.
Yeah, it was spectacular. And I think the thing that curtailed it was David's passion for doing the fourth season of Deadwood, which didn't happen. So I think one kind of canceled out the other. His focus got shifted from one to the other. And it's a shame because Deadwood was unique, not for everybody, but it was a work of art on television. I mean, that still is startling in its quality. And I mentioned this, I believe, on your show, but the people who worked on Deadwood, we usually had two camera crews going, and one of the camera crews was the same crew Alan Parker had to shoot Mississippi Burning.
Oh, wow.
We're talking about the best of the best worked on Deadwood. Crazy.
That was great. Well, Stephen, it's always great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
I love it. And is it a winter wonderland in Maine?
It was for about a week and a half, and then it got really warm and it rained, and we have bare ground outside now.
Oh, no. Well, anyway, I wish you and your family and everybody in Maine that I love so much the happiest of Christmases.
Well, we hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday. I hope you get some quality grandparent time.
Oh, we do. We're going to have good grandparent time with baby Dior, I promise.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Be well.
You got it.